I was so thirsty that I chugged it until it was empty. Then I opened the other one and drank from that, too, unable to stop myself. The thermometer that dangled from the zipper on my pack said it was 100 degrees in my shaded patch. I sang cool songs as I walked, the sun beating me as if it had an actual physical force that consisted of more than heat. Sweat collected around my sunglasses and streamed into my eyes, stinging them so I had to stop and wipe my face every now and then. It seemed impossible that I'd been up in the snowy mountains wearing all of my clothes only the week before, that I'd awakened to a thick layer of frost on my tent walls each morning. I couldn't rightly remember it. Those white days seemed like a dream, as if all this time I'd been staggering north in the scorching heat into this, my fifth week on the trail, straight through the same heat that had almost driven me off the trail in my second week. I stopped and drank again. The water was so hot it almost hurt my mouth. Sagebrush and a sprawl of hardy wildflowers blanketed the wide plain. As I walked, scratchy plants I couldn't identify grazed my calves. Others I knew seemed to speak to me, saying their names to me in my mother's voice. Names I didn't realize I knew until they came so clearly into my mind. Queen Anne's lace, Indian paintbrush, lupin, those same flowers grew in Minnesota, white and orange and purple. When we passed them as we drove, my mother would sometimes stop the car and pick a bouquet from what grew in the ditch. I stopped walking and looked up at the sky. The birds of prey still circled, hardly seeming to flap their wings. I will never go home, I thought with a finality that made me catch my breath. And then I walked on, my mind emptying into nothing but the effort to push my body through the bald monotony of the hike. There wasn't a day on the trail when that monotony didn't ultimately win out, when the only thing to think about was whatever was the physically hardest. It was a sort of scorching cure. I counted my steps, working my way to 100, and starting over again at 1. Each time I completed another set, it seemed as if I'd achieved a small thing. Then 100 became too optimistic, and I went to 50, then 25, then 10. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I stopped and bent over, pressing my hands to my knees to ease my back for a moment. The sweat dripped from my face onto the pale dirt like tears. The Modoc Plateau was different from the Mojave Desert, but it didn't feel different. Both teemed with jagged desert plants while being entirely inhospitable to human life. Tiny gray and brown lizards either zipped across the trail as I approached or held their position as I passed. Where did they get water, I wondered, trying to stop myself from thinking about how hot and thirsty I was. Where would I? I was 3 miles away from the water tank, I reckoned. I had 8 ounces of water left. Then 6. Then 4. I forced myself not to drink the last 2 until I had the water tank in sight. And by 4:30, there it was, the stilted legs of the burned fire lookout on a rise in the distance. Nearby was a metal tank propped up against a post. As soon as I saw it, I pulled out my bottle and drank the last of my water, thankful that in a matter of minutes I'd be able to drink my fill from the tank. As I approached, I saw that the wooden post near the tank was covered with something that flapped in the wind. It looked like several shredded ribbons at first, and then a ripped cloth. It wasn't until I got up close that I saw they were tiny scraps of paper, notes stuck to the post with duct tape and now fluttering in the wind. I lurched forward to read them, knowing what they would say even before my eyes met the paper. They said what they said in various ways, but they all bore the same message: no water. I stood motionless for a moment, paralyzed with dread. I gazed into the tank to confirm what was true. There was no water. I had no water. Not even a sip. No water, No water, no water, no water, no water. I kicked the dirt and grabbed fistfuls of sage and threw them, furious with myself for yet again doing the wrong thing, for being the same idiot I'd been the very day I set foot on the trail, the same one who had purchased the wrong size boots and profoundly underestimated the amount of money I'd need for the summer, and even maybe the same idiot who believed I could hike this trail. I pulled the ripped-out guidebook pages from my shorts pocket and read them again. I wasn't scared in the same way I'd been earlier in the day, when I had the funny feeling that something was lurking nearby. Now, I was terrified. This wasn't a feeling, it was a fact. I was miles from water on a 100-and-something-degree day. I knew that this was the most serious situation I'd been in so far on the trail. More threatening than the marauding bull, more harrowing than the snow. I needed water. I needed it soon. I needed it now. I could feel that need in my every pore. I remembered Albert asking me how many times I urinated each day when I'd first met him. I hadn't peed since I'd left Old Station that morning. I hadn't needed to. Every ounce I'd ingested had been used. I was so thirsty I couldn't even spit. The authors of the Pacific Crest Trail, Volume 1, California, said the nearest reliable water was 15 miles away at Rock Spring Creek. But they conceded there was, in fact, water nearer by in a reservoir that they strongly advised against drinking from, calling its quality questionable at best. That water was nearly 5 miles farther up the trail. Unless, of course, the reservoir had also gone dry. There was a distinct chance that it had, I acknowledged, as I did my version of racing toward it, which, given the condition of my feet and the weight of my pack, was nothing more than a decidedly brisk walk. It felt as if I could see the entire world from the east rim of Hat Creek. A wide valley spread below me into the distance, interrupted by green volcanic mountains to both the north and the south. Even in my anxious state, I couldn't help but feel rapturous at the beauty. I was a big fat idiot, yes. One who might die of dehydration and heat exhaustion, yes. But at least I was in a beautiful place. A place I'd come to love, in spite and because of its hardships. And I'd gotten myself into this place on my own 2 feet. Consoling myself with this, I walked on, so thirsty that I became nauseated and slightly feverish. I'll be okay, I told myself. It's just another bit farther, I said around each bend and over every rise as the sun sank toward the horizon, until at last I saw the reservoir. I stopped to gaze at it. It was a miserable-looking, mucky pond about the size of a tennis court, but there was water in it. I was laughing with joy as I staggered down the slope toward the little dirt beach that surrounded the reservoir. I'd hiked my first 20-mile day. I unbuckled Monster and set it onto the ground and went to the muddy shore and squatted to put my hands in the water. It was gray and warm as blood. When I moved my hands, the muck from the bottom rose in weedy tendrils and streaked the water black. I got my purifier and pumped the questionable liquid into my bottle. My purifier had remained as difficult to use as it had been that first time I used it at Golden Oak Springs, but it was especially difficult in this water, so dense with sludge that it half jammed my filter. By the time I was done filling one bottle, my arm shook with fatigue. I went to my first aid kit and took out my iodine pills and dropped a couple into the water. I'd brought the pills for just this reason, reinforcement should I ever be compelled to drink water that was likely contaminated. Even Albert had thought the iodine pills a good idea back in Kennedy Meadows, when he'd been ruthlessly tossing things into the get-rid-of pile. Albert, who'd been felled by a waterborne illness the very next day. I had to wait 30 minutes for the iodine to do its work before it was safe to drink. I was desperately thirsty, but I distracted myself by filling my other bottle with water. When I was done, I laid out my tarp on the dirt beach, stood on top of it, and took off my clothes. The wind had mellowed with the fading light. In gentle wafts, it cooled the hot patches on my naked hips. It didn't occur to me that anyone might come along the trail. I hadn't seen a soul all day, and even if someone did come along, I was too catatonic with dehydration and exhaustion to care. I looked at my watch. 27 minutes had passed since I'd plopped the iodine pills into my water. Usually, I was starving by evening, but the idea of eating was nothing to me now. Water was my only desire. I sat on my blue tarp and drank one bottle down and then the other. The warm water tasted like iron and mud, and yet seldom have I ever consumed anything so amazing. I could feel it moving into me, though even once I'd had 2 32-ounce bottles, I wasn't entirely restored. I still wasn't hungry. I felt like I had in those first days on the trail, when I'd been so astoundingly exhausted that all my body wanted was sleep. Now all my body wanted was water. I filled my bottles again, let the iodine purify them, and drank them both. By the time I was sated, it was dark, and the full moon was rising. I couldn't muster the energy to set up my tent, a task that required little more than 2 minutes' effort, which now seemed Herculean to me. I didn't need a tent. It hadn't rained since my first couple of days on the trail. I put my clothes back on and spread out my sleeping bag on the tarp, but it was too hot still to do anything but lie on top of it. I was too tired to read. Even gazing at the moon felt like a mild effort. I'd consumed 128 ounces of questionable reservoir water since I'd arrived a couple of hours before, and I still didn't have to pee. I had done a stupendously dumb thing by setting out across Hat Creek Rim with so little water. I'll never be so careless again, I promised the moon before falling asleep. I woke 2 hours later with the vaguely pleasant sensation that tiny cool hands were gently patting me. They were on my bare legs and arms and face and in my hair, on my feet and throat and hands. I could feel their cool weight through my t-shirt on my chest and belly. "Hmm," I moaned, turning slightly, before I opened my eyes and a series of facts came to me in slow motion. There was the fact of the moon, and the fact that I was sleeping out in the open on my tarp. There was the fact that I had woken because it seemed like small, cool hands were gently patting me, and the fact that small, cool hands were gently patting me. And then there was the final fact of all, which was a fact more monumental than even the moon, the fact that those small, cool hands were not hands, but hundreds of small, cool, black frogs. Small, cool, slimy black frogs jumping all over me. Each one was the approximate size of a potato chip. They were an amphibious army, a damp, smooth-skinned militia, a great web-footed migration, and I was in their path as they hopped, scrambled, leapt, and hurled their tiny, pudgy, bent-legged bodies from the reservoir and onto the scrim of dirt that they no doubt considered their private beach. Within an instant, I was among them, hopping, scrambling, leaping, and hurling myself, my pack, my tarp, and everything that sat on it into the brush beyond the beach, swatting frogs from my hair and the folds of my t-shirt as I went. I couldn't help but squash a few beneath my bare feet. Finally safe, I stood watching them from the frog-free perimeter, the frantic motion of their little dark bodies apparent in the blazing moonlight. I checked my shorts pockets for errant frogs. I gathered my things into a little clear patch that seemed flat enough for my tent and pulled it from my pack. I didn't need to see what I was doing. My tent was up with the flick of my wrist. I crawled out of it at 8:30 the next morning. 8:30 was late for me, like noon in my former life. And this 8:30 felt like noon in my former life, too, like I'd been out drinking into the wee hours. I half stood, looking around groggily. I still didn't have to pee. I packed up and pumped more filthy water and walked north beneath the scorching sun. It was even hotter than it had been the day before. Within an hour, I almost stepped on another rattlesnake, though it too warned me off politely with its rattle. By late afternoon, any thought of making it all the way to MacArthur Burney Falls Memorial State Park by day's end had been shot down entirely by my late start, my throbbing and blistered feet, and the staggering heat. Instead, I took a short detour off the trail to Castle, where my guidebook promised there would be a general store. It was nearly 3 by the time I reached it. I took off my pack and sat on a wooden chair on the store's old-fashioned porch, nearly catatonic from the heat. The big thermometer in the shade read 102 degrees. I counted my money, feeling on the verge of tears, knowing that no matter how much I had, it wouldn't be enough for a Snapple lemonade. My desire for one had grown so large that it wasn't even a longing anymore. It was more like a limb growing from my gut. It would cost 99 cents, or $1.05 or $1.15. I didn't know how much exactly. I knew I had only 76 cents, and that wouldn't be enough. I went into the store anyway, just to look. "You a PCT hiker?" the woman behind the counter asked. "Yeah," I said, smiling at her. "Where you from?" "Minnesota," I called as I made my way along a bank of glass-fronted doors with cold drinks lined up in neat rows inside. I passed cans of icy beer and soda pop, bottles of mineral water and juice. I stopped at the door where the racks of Snapples were kept. I put my hand to the glass near the bottles of lemonade. There was both yellow and pink. They were like diamonds or pornography. I could look, but I couldn't touch. "If you're done hiking for the day, you're welcome to camp out in the field behind the store," the woman said to me. "We let all the PCT hikers stay there." "Thanks, I think I'll do that," I said, still staring at the drinks. Perhaps I could just hold one, I thought. Just press it against my forehead for a moment. I opened the door and pulled out a bottle of pink lemonade. It was so cold it felt like it was burning my hand. "How much is this?" I couldn't keep myself from asking.
"I saw you counting your pennies outside," the woman laughed. "How much you got?"
I gave her everything I had while thanking her profusely and took the Snapple out onto the porch. Each sip sent a stab of heady pleasure through me. I held the bottle with both hands, wanting to absorb every bit of cool I could. Cars pulled up and people got out and went into the store, then came out and drove away. I watched them for an hour in a post-Snapple bliss that felt more like a drugged-up haze. After a while, a pickup slowed in front of the store just long enough for a man to climb out of the back and pull out his backpack behind him before waving the driver away. He turned to me and spotted my pack.
"Hey," he said, a giant smile spreading across his pink, beefy face. "It's one hell of a hot day to hike on the PCT, don't you think?"
His name was Rex. He was a big red-haired guy, gregarious and gay and 38 years old. He struck me as the kind of person who gave a lot of bear hugs. He went into the store and bought 3 cans of beer and drank them as he sat beside me on the porch, where together we talked into the evening. He lived in Phoenix and held a corporate job he couldn't properly make me understand, but he'd grown up in a little town in southern Oregon. He'd hiked from the Mexican border to Mojave in the spring, getting off the trail at the very place where I'd gotten on, and at about the same time as well, to return to Phoenix for 6 weeks to tend to some business matters before starting back on the trail at Old Station, having elegantly bypassed all the snow.
"I think you need new boots," he said, when I showed him my feet, echoing Greg's and Brent's sentiments.
"But I can't get new boots. I don't have the money," I told him, no longer too ashamed to admit it.
"Where'd you buy them?" asked Rex.
"REI."
"Call them. They've got a satisfaction guarantee. They'll replace them for free."
"They will?"
"Call the 1-800 number," he said.
I thought about it all through the evening as Rex and I camped together in the field behind the store, and all the next day as I raced faster than ever through 12 mercifully unchallenging miles to MacArthur Burney Falls Memorial State Park. When I arrived, I immediately collected my resupply box from the concessionaire store and went to the payphone nearby to call the operator and then REI. Within 5 minutes, the woman I spoke to had agreed to mail me a new pair of boots, one size larger, via overnight mail. No charge.
Are you sure? I kept asking her, yammering on about the trouble my two small boots had caused me. Yes, she said placidly. And now it was official. I loved REI more than I loved the people behind Snapple Lemonade. I gave her the address of the park store, reading it from my as-yet-unopened box. I'd have jumped with joy after I hung up the phone if my feet had been well enough to do it. I ripped open my box and found my $20 and joined the crowd of tourists in the line, hoping none of them would notice that I reeked. I bought an ice cream cone and sat at a picnic table, eating it with barely restrained glee. Rex walked up as I sat there, and a few minutes after that, Trina appeared with her big white dog. We embraced, and I introduced her to Rex. She and Stacy had arrived the day before. She'd decided to get off the trail here and return to Colorado to do several day hikes near her home for the rest of the summer instead of hiking the PCT. Stacy would be continuing on as planned. I'm sure she'd be happy if you joined her, Trina added. She'll be hiking out in the morning. I can't, I said, and giddily explained that I needed to wait for my new boots. We worried about you on Hat Creek Rim, she said. No water at... I know, I said, and we ruefully shook our heads. Come, she said to Rex and me. I'll show you where we're camped. It's a 20-minute walk, but it's away from all this. She gestured with an air of disdain toward the tourists, the snack bar, and the store. Plus, it's free. My feet had gotten to the point that each time I rested, it hurt more the next time I got up to walk, their various sores reopening with every new effort. I limped behind Trina and Rex down a path through the woods that took us back to the PCT, where there was a small clearing among the trees. Cheryl, Stacy called, coming to hug me. We talked about Hat Creek Rim and the heat, the trail and the lack of water, and what the snack bar had to offer for dinner. I took off my boots and socks and put on my camp sandals and set up my tent and went through the pleasant ritual of unpacking my box while we chatted. Stacy and Rex made fast friends and decided to hike the next section of the trail together. By the time I was ready to walk back up to the snack bar for dinner, my big toes had swollen and reddened so much that they looked like two beets. I couldn't even bear to wear socks anymore, so I hobbled up to the snack bar in my sandals instead, where we sat around a picnic table with paper boats of hot dogs and jalapeno poppers and nachos with fluorescent orange cheese dripping off the sides. It felt like a feast and a celebration. We held up our wax cups of soda pop and made a toast. To Trina and Odin's trip home, we said and clinked our cups. To Stacy and Rex hitting the trail, we cheered. To Cheryl's new boots, we yelled. And I drank with solemnity to that. When I woke the next morning, my tent was the only one in the clearing among the trees. I walked up to the bathhouse meant for the campers in the official park campground, took a shower, and returned to my campsite, where I sat in my camp chair for hours. I ate breakfast and read half of A Summer Birdcage in one sitting. In the afternoon, I walked to the store near the snack bar to see if my boots were there, but the woman who worked at the counter told me the mail hadn't arrived yet. I left forlornly, strolling in my sandals down a short paved path to an overlook to see the Grand Falls that the park is named for. Burney Falls is the most voluminous waterfall in the state of California for most of the year, a sign explained. As I gazed at the thundering water, I felt almost invisible among the people with their cameras, fanny packs, and Bermuda shorts. I sat on a bench and watched a couple feed an entire pack of breath savers to a gaggle of overly familiar squirrels who darted around a sign that said, "Do not feed the wildlife." It enraged me to see them do that, but my fury was not only about how they were perpetuating the habituation of the squirrels, I realized. It was also that they were a couple. To witness the way they leaned into each other and laced their fingers together and tugged each other tenderly down the paved path was almost unbearable. I was simultaneously sickened by it and envious of what they had. Their existence seemed proof that I would never succeed at romantic love. I'd felt so strong and content while talking on the phone with Paul in Old Station only a few days before. But I didn't feel anything like that anymore. Everything that had rested then was roiling now. I limped back to my camp and examined my tortured big toes, to so much as graze against them had become excruciating. I could literally see them throbbing, the blood beneath my flesh pulsating in a regular rhythm that flushed my nails white then pink, white then pink. They were so swollen that it looked as if my nails were simply going to pop off. It occurred to me that popping them off might actually be a good idea. I pinched one of the nails, and with a solid tug, followed by a second of searing pain, the nail gave way, and I felt instant, almost total relief. A moment later, I did the same with the other toe. It was me against the PCT when it came to my toenails, I realized. The score was 6-4, and I was just barely hanging on to my lead. By nightfall, four other PCT hikers joined my encampment. They arrived as I was burning the last pages of a summer birdcage in my little aluminum pie pan. Two couples, about my age, who'd hiked all the way from Mexico, minus the same section of the socked-in Sierra Nevada I'd skipped. Each couple had set out separately, but they'd met and joined forces in Southern California, hiking and bypassing the snow together in a weeks-long wilderness double date. John and Sarah were from Alberta, Canada, and hadn't even been dating a year when they'd started to hike the PCT. Sam and Helen were a married couple from Maine. They were laying over the next day, but I was heading on, I told them, as soon as my new boots arrived. The next morning, I packed up Monster and walked to the store wearing my sandals, my boots tied to the frame of my pack. I sat at one of the nearby picnic tables waiting for the mail to arrive. I was eager to hike away, not so much because I felt like hiking, but because I had to. In order to reach each resupply point on roughly the day I'd anticipated, I had a schedule to keep. In spite of all the changes and bypasses, for reasons related to both money and weather, I needed to stick to my plan to finish my trip by mid-September. I sat for hours reading the book that had come in my box, Vladimir Nabokov's Lolita, while waiting for my boots to arrive. People came and went in waves, sometimes gathering in little circles around me to ask questions about the PCT when they noticed my pack. As I spoke, the doubts I had about myself on the trail fell away for whole minutes at a time, and I forgot all about being a big fat idiot. Basking in the attention of the people who gathered around me, I didn't just feel like a backpacking expert. I felt like a hard-ass motherfucking Amazonian queen. "I advise you to put this on your resume," said an old woman from Florida, adorned in a bright pink visor and a fistful of gold necklaces. "I used to work in HR. Employers look for things like this. It tells them that you've got character. It sets you apart from the rest." The mailman pulled up around 3. The UPS guy came an hour later. Neither one of them had my boots. My stomach sinking, I went to the payphone and called REI. They hadn't yet mailed my boots, the man I spoke to politely informed me. The problem was, they'd learned they could not get them to the state park overnight, so they wanted to send them by regular mail instead, but because they hadn't known how to contact me to tell me this, they'd done nothing at all. "I don't think you understand," I said. "I'm hiking the PCT. I'm sleeping in the woods. Of course you couldn't have gotten in touch with me, and I can't wait here for... How long will it take for my boots to come in the regular mail?"
"Approximately 5 days," he replied, unperturbed.
"5 days?" I asked. I couldn't exactly be upset. They were mailing me a new pair of boots for free, after all. But still, I was frustrated and panicked. In addition to maintaining my schedule, I needed the food I had in my bag for the next section of the trail, the 83-mile stretch that took me to Castle Crags. If I stayed in Burney Falls to wait for my boots, I'd have to eat that food because, with little more than $5 left, I didn't have enough money to spend the next 5 days eating from the park snack bar. I reached for my pack, got my guidebook, and found the address for Castle Crags.
I couldn't imagine hiking another blistering 83 miles in my two small boots, but I had no choice but to ask REI to send them there. When I hung up the phone, I didn't feel like a hard-ass motherfucking Amazonian queen anymore. I stared at my boots with a pleading expression, as if we could possibly work out a deal. They were dangling from my pack by their dusty red laces, evil in their indifference. I'd planned to leave them in the PCT hiker free box as soon as my new boots arrived. I reached for them, but I couldn't bring myself to put them on. Perhaps I could wear my flimsy camp sandals for short stretches on the trail. I'd met a few people who switched off between boots and sandals while they hiked, but their sandals were far sturdier than mine. I'd never intended to wear my sandals to hike. I'd brought them only to give my feet a break from my boots at the end of the day, cheap knockoffs I'd purchased at a discount store for something like $19.99. I took them off and cradled them in my hands as if by examining them up close I could bestow on them a durability they did not possess. The Velcro was matted with detritus and peeling away from the black straps at the frayed ends. Their blue soles were malleable as dough and so thin that when I walked I could feel the contours of pebbles and sticks beneath my feet. Wearing them was just barely more than having no shoes on at all. And I was going to walk to Castle Crags in these? Maybe I shouldn't, I thought. Maybe I wouldn't. This far was far enough. I could put it on my resume. Fuck, I said. I picked up a rock and whipped it hard as I could at a nearby tree, and then another and another. I thought of the woman I always thought of in such moments, an astrologer who'd read my natal chart when I was 23. A friend had arranged for the reading as a going-away gift just before I left Minnesota for New York City. The astrologer was a no-nonsense middle-aged woman named Pat, who sat me down at her kitchen table with a piece of paper covered in mysterious markings and a quietly whirring tape recorder between us. I didn't put much faith in it. I thought it would be a bit of fun, an ego-boosting session during which she'd say generic things like, "You have a kind heart." But she didn't. Or rather, she said those things, but she also said bizarrely specific things that were so accurate and particular, so simultaneously consoling and upsetting, that it was all I could do not to bawl in recognition and grief. "How can you know this?" I kept demanding. And then I would listen as she explained about the planets, the sun and the moon, the aspects and the moment I was born, about what it meant to be a Virgo, with a moon in Leo and Gemini rising. I'd nod while thinking, this is a bunch of crazy New Age anti-intellectual bullshit. And then she'd say another thing that would blow my brain into about 7,000 pieces because it was so true. Until she began to speak of my father. "Was he a Vietnam vet?" she asked. "No," I told her, "he wasn't. He was in the military briefly in the mid-1960s. In fact, he was stationed at the base in Colorado Springs where my mother's father was stationed, which is how my parents met, but he never went to Vietnam." "It seems he was like a Vietnam vet," she persisted. "Perhaps not literally, but he has something in common with some of those men. He was deeply wounded. He was damaged. His damage has infected his life, and it infected you." I was not going to nod. Everything that had ever happened to me in my whole life was mixed into the cement that kept my head perfectly still at the moment an astrologer told me that my father had infected me. "Wounded?" was all I could manage. "Yes," said Pat. "And you're wounded in the same place. That's what fathers do if they don't heal their wounds. They wound their children in the same place." "Hmm," I said, my face blank. "I could be wrong." She gazed down at the paper between us. "This isn't necessarily literal." "Actually, I only saw my father 3 times after I was 6, I said. "The father's job is to teach his children how to be warriors, to give them the confidence to get on the horse and ride into battle when it's necessary to do so. If you don't get that from your father, you have to teach yourself.
But I think I have already, I sputtered. I'm strong, I face things, I...
This isn't about strength, said Pat. And you may not be able to see this yet, but perhaps there will come a time, it could be years from now, when you'll need to get on your horse and ride into battle, and you're going to hesitate. You're going to falter. To heal the wound your father made, you're going to have to get on that horse and ride into battle like a warrior.
I laughed a bit then, a self-conscious puff croak of a chuckle that sounded more sad than happy.
I know because I took the cassette tape home and listened to it over and over again. To heal the wound your father made, you're going to have to get on that horse and ride into battle like a warrior.
Puff, croak.
Rewind, repeat.
Would you like a knuckle sandwich? My father used to ask me when he was angry, holding his man fist an inch from my 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 year old face.
Would you?
Huh?
Huh?
Huh? Answer me!
I put on my stupid sandals and began the long walk to Castle Crags. Chapter 13. The Accumulation of Trees. It was a woman who first thought of the PCT. She was a retired teacher from Bellingham, Washington, named Catherine Montgomery. In a conversation with mountaineer and writer Joseph T. Hazard, she suggested that there should be a border-to-border, high trail winding down the heights of our western mountains. It was 1926. Though a small group of hikers immediately embraced Montgomery's idea, it wasn't until Clinton Churchill Clark took up the cause 6 years later that a clear vision of the PCT began to coalesce. Clark was an oil man who lived in leisure in Pasadena, but he was also an avid outdoorsman. Appalled by a culture that spent too much time sitting on soft seats in motors, too much sitting in soft seats in movies, Clark lobbied the federal government to set aside a wilderness corridor for the trail. His vision went far beyond the PCT, which he hoped would be a mere segment of a much longer Trail of the Americas that would run from Alaska to Chile. He believed that time in the wilderness provided a lasting curative and civilizing value, and he spent 25 years advocating for the PCT, though when he died in 1957, the trail was still only a dream. Perhaps Clark's most important contribution to the trail was making the acquaintance of Warren Rogers, who was 24 when the two met in 1932. Rogers was working for the YMCA in Alhambra, California, when Clark convinced him to help map the route by assigning teams of YMCA volunteers to chart and, in some cases, construct what would become the PCT. Though initially reluctant, Rogers soon became passionate about the trail's creation, and he spent the rest of his life championing the PCT and working to overcome all the legal, financial, and logistical obstacles that stood in its way. Rogers lived to see Congress designate the Pacific Crest National Scenic Trail in 1968, but he died in 1992, a year before the trail was finished. I'd read the section in my guidebook about the trail's history the winter before, but it wasn't until now, a couple of miles out of Burney Falls, as I walked in my flimsy sandals in the early evening heat, that the realization of what that story meant picked up force and hit me squarely in the chest. Preposterous as it was, when Catherine Montgomery and Clinton Clark and Warren Rogers and the hundreds of others who'd created the PCT had imagined the people who would walk that high trail that wound down the heights of our western mountains, they'd been imagining me. It didn't matter that everything from my cheap knockoff sandals to my high-tech, by 1995 standards, boots and backpack would have been foreign to them, because what mattered was utterly timeless. It was the thing that had compelled them to fight for the trail against all the odds, and it was the thing that drove me and every other long-distance hiker onward on the most miserable days. It had nothing to do with gear or footwear, or the backpacking fads or philosophies of any particular era or even with getting from point A to point B. It had only to do with how it felt to be in the wild, with what it was like to walk for miles for no reason other than to witness the accumulation of trees and meadows, mountains and deserts, streams and rocks, rivers and grasses, sunrises and sunsets. The experience was powerful and fundamental. It seemed to me that it had always felt like this to be a human in the wild, and as long as the wild existed, it would always feel this way. That's what Montgomery knew, I supposed, and what Clark knew and Rogers, and what thousands of people who preceded and followed them knew. It was what I knew before I even really did, before I could have known how truly hard and glorious the PCT would be, how profoundly the trail would both shatter and shelter me. I thought about this as I walked into my sixth week on the trail beneath the humid shade of ponderosa pines and Douglas firs. The trail's gravelly surface was palpable to the soles of my feet through the bottoms of my thin sandals. The muscles of my ankles felt strained without my boots to support them, but at least my sore toes weren't bumping up against my boots with each step. I hiked until I came to a wooden bridge that spanned a creek. Unable to find a flat spot nearby, I pitched my tent right on the bridge, which was the trail itself, and slept hearing the delicate thunder of the small waterfall beneath me all night long. I woke at first light and hiked in my sandals for a few hours, climbing nearly 1,700 feet, while catching an occasional view of Burney Mountain to the south, when I emerged from the shade of the fir and pine forests I was passing through. When I stopped to eat lunch, I reluctantly untied my boots from my pack, feeling I had no choice but to put them on. I'd begun to see evidence of what the authors of the Pacific Crest Trail Volume 1, California, had noted in their introduction to the section describing the miles between Burney Falls and Castle Crags. They'd written that the trail in this section was so ill-maintained that it was little better than cross-country hiking in places. And though I hadn't yet seen that, such a warning didn't bode well for my sandals. Already they'd begun to give out, their bottoms splitting apart and flapping beneath me with each step, catching small twigs and pebbles as I went. I forced my feet back into my boots and continued on, ignoring the pain as I ascended past an eerie pair of electrical towers that made otherworldly crackling sounds. A few times throughout the day, I saw Bald Mountain and Grizzly Peak to the northwest, dark green and brown mountains covered with smatterings of scraggly windblown trees and bushes. But mostly I walked in a bushy forest, crossing an increasing number of primitive roads cut with the deep treads of tractors. I passed old clear cuts that were slowly coming back to life, great fields of stumps and roots and small green trees that stood no higher than me, where the trail became untenable in places, difficult to track among the litter of blown-down trees and branches. The trees were the same species as those I'd hiked past often on the trail. But the forest felt different, desultory and somehow darker, in spite of the intermittent expanse of views. Late in the afternoon, I stopped for a break in a spot on the trail with a view over the rolling green land. I was on a slope, the mountain rising above me, and descending steeply below. With no other place to sit, I sat on the trail itself, as I often did. I pulled off my boots and socks and massaged my feet as I stared out across the tops of the trees, my perch on the trail essentially a ledge over the forest. I loved the sensation of feeling taller than the trees, of seeing their canopy from above as a bird would. The sight of it eased my sense of worry over the state of my feet and the rough trail ahead. It was in this reverie that I reached for the side pocket of my pack. When I pulled on the pocket zipper, Monster toppled over onto my boots, clipping the left one in such a way that it leapt into the air as if I'd thrown it. I watched it bounce. It was lightning fast and in slow motion all at once. And then I watched it tumble over the edge of the mountain and down into the trees without a sound. I gasped in surprise and lurched for my other boot, clutching it to my chest. waiting for the moment to reverse itself, for someone to come laughing from the woods, shaking his head and saying it had all been a joke. But no one laughed. No one would. The universe, I'd learned, was never, ever kidding. It would take whatever it wanted, and it would never give it back. I really did have only one boot. So I stood up and tossed the other one over the edge, too. I looked down at my bare feet, staring at them for a long moment, then began repairing my sandals with duct tape as best I could, sealing the bottoms back together, and reinforcing the straps where they threatened to detach. I wore my socks inside the sandals to protect my feet from the lines of tape and hiked away feeling sick about the new state of affairs, but reassuring myself that at least I had a new pair of boots waiting for me in Castle Crags. By evening, the forest opened into a wide swath of what can only be called wilderness rubble, a landscape ripped up by its seams and logged clear, the PCT picking its way faintly along its edges. Several times I had to stop walking to search for the trail, obstructed as it was by fallen branches and clumps of turned-up soil. The trees that remained standing on the edge of the clear-cut seemed to mourn, their rough hides newly exposed, their jagged limbs reaching out at absurd angles. I'd never seen anything like it in the woods. It was as if someone had come along with a giant wrecking ball and let it swing. Was this the wilderness corridor Congress had in mind when they'd set it aside? It didn't seem so, but I was hiking through national forest land, which, in spite of its promising name, meant that I was on land that the powers that be could use as they saw fit for the public good. Sometimes that meant that the land would remain untouched, as it had been on most of the PCT. Other times it meant that ancient trees were chopped down to make things like chairs and toilet paper. The sight of the churned, barren earth unsettled me. I felt sad and angry about it, but in a way that included the complicated truth of my own complicity. I used tables and chairs and toilet paper too, after all. As I picked my way through the rubble, I knew I was done for the day. I mounted a steep berm to reach the flattened clear-cut above, and pitched my tent among the stumps and upturned mounds of soil, feeling lonely the way I seldom did on the trail. I wanted to talk to someone, and it wasn't just anyone I wanted to talk to. I wanted to talk to Karen or Leif or Eddie. I wanted to have a family again, to be folded into something I believed was safe from destruction. Right alongside my longing for them, I felt something as hot as hate for each of them now. I imagined a big machine, like the one that had mawed up this forest, mawing up our 40 acres in the Minnesota woods. I wished with all my heart that it really would. I would be free then, it seemed, because we had not been safe from destruction after my mom died. Total destruction would come now as a relief. The loss of my family and home were my own private clear-cut. What remained was only ugly evidence of a thing that was no more. I'd last been home the week before I left to hike the PCT. I'd driven up north to say goodbye to Eddie and to visit my mother's grave, knowing I wouldn't return to Minnesota after I finished my hike. I worked my last shift at the restaurant where I waited tables in Minneapolis and drove 3 hours north, arriving at 1 in the morning. I'd planned to park in the driveway and sleep in the back of my truck so as not to disturb anyone in the house. But when I arrived, there was a party in progress. The house was lit up, and in the yard there was a bonfire. Tents were scattered all around, and loud music blared from speakers propped in the grass. It was the Saturday of Memorial Day weekend. I got out of my truck and walked through throngs of people, most of them unknown to me. I was taken aback, but not surprised, by either the raucous nature of the party or the fact that I hadn't been invited. It was only further evidence of how profoundly things had changed. "Cheryl!" Leif bellowed when I entered the garage packed with people. I pushed my way toward him through the crowd, and we embraced. "I'm tripping on shrooms," he told me cheerfully, clutching too hard on my arm. Where's Eddie? I asked.
I don't know, but I got something to show you, he said, tugging on me. It's guaranteed to piss you off.
I followed him into the yard and up the front stairs of our house and through the door until we were standing before our kitchen table. It was the same one we'd had in the tree loft apartments when we were kids, the one our mother had bought for $10, the one we'd eaten on that first night we met Eddie, when we thought we were Chinese because we sat on the floor. It was the height of a normal table now. After we'd moved out of tree loft and into a regular house with Eddie, he'd cut off the short legs and bolted a barrel to the bottom, and we'd eaten off of it all these years sitting in chairs. The table had never been fancy, and it had become less so over the years, cracking in places that Eddie repaired with wood putty. But it had been ours. Or at least, it had been. Until that night the week before I left to go hike the PCT. Now the surface of the table was smattered with freshly carved words and phrases, and names and initials of people linked by plus signs or rimmed with hearts, obviously made by those at the party. As we looked on, a teenaged boy I didn't know carved into the table's surface with a Swiss Army knife.
"Stop it," I commanded,
and he looked at me with alarm.
"That table is..."
I couldn't finish what I wanted to say. I only turned and bolted out the door. Leaf trailed behind me as we walked past the tents and the bonfire, past the chicken coop that was now devoid of chickens, and away from the horse pasture, where no horses lived anymore, and down a trail into the woods to the gazebo that was back there, where I sat and cried, while my brother stayed quietly by my side. I was disgusted with Eddie, but more, I was sick with myself. I'd burned candles and made proclamations in my journal. I'd come to healthy conclusions about acceptance and gratitude, about fate and forgiveness and fortune. In a small, fierce place inside me, I'd let my mother go and my father go, and I'd finally let Eddie go as well. But the table was another thing. It hadn't occurred to me that I'd have to let that go, too. "I'm so glad I'm leaving Minnesota," I said, the words bitter in my mouth. "So glad."
"I'm not," said Leaf.
He put his hand on my hair at the back of my head and then took it away.
"I don't mean I'm glad to be leaving you," I said,
wiping my face and nose with my hands.
"But I hardly ever see you anyway."
It was true. Much as he claimed that I was the most important person in his life, his second mother, he sometimes called me, I saw him only intermittently. He was elusive and vague, irresponsible and nearly impossible to track down. His phone was constantly being disconnected. His living situations were always temporary.
"You can visit me," I said.
"Visit you where?" he asked.
"Wherever I decide to live in the fall, after I'm done with the PCT.
I thought about where I'd live. I couldn't imagine where it would be. It could be anywhere. The only thing I knew was that it wouldn't be here.
"Not in this state. Not in this state,"
my mother had disconcertedly insisted in the days before she died, when I'd pressed her to tell me where she'd like us to spread her ashes. I couldn't ever get from her what she meant by that, if she was referring to the state of Minnesota or the state she was in, her weakened and confused condition.
"Maybe Oregon," I said to Leaf,
and we were quiet for a while.
"The gazebo's cool in the dark," he whispered a few minutes later,
and we both looked around, seeing it in the shadowy nightlight. Paul and I had gotten married in it. We'd built it together for the occasion of our wedding nearly 7 years before, along with help from Eddie and my mom. It was the humble castle of our naive, ill-fated love. The roof was corrugated tin. The sides, unsanded wood that would give you splinters if you touched it. The floor was packed dirt and flat stones we'd hauled through the woods in a blue wheelbarrow my family had owned for ages. After I married Paul in the gazebo, it had become the place in our woods where people would walk to when they walked, congregate when they congregated. Eddie had hung a wide rope hammock across its length, a gift to my mother years before.
"Let's get in this thing," Leaf said, gesturing to the hammock.
We climbed in, and I rocked us gently, pushing off with one foot from the very stone upon which I'd stood when I'd married Paul. "I'm divorced now," I said without emotion.
"I thought you were divorced before."
"Well, now it's official. We had to send our paperwork to the state so they could process it. I just got the final papers last week with a stamp from the judge."
He nodded and said nothing. It seemed he had little pity for me and the divorce I'd brought on myself.
He, Eddie, and Karen liked Paul. I couldn't make them understand why I'd had to smash things up.
"But you seemed so happy," was all they could say.
And it was true. We had seemed that way, just as I'd seemed to be doing okay after my mom died. Grief doesn't have a face. As Leif and I swung in the hammock, we caught glimpses of the house lights and the bonfire through the trees. We could hear the dim voices of the partiers as the party died down and disappeared. Our mother's grave was close behind us, maybe only another 30 steps farther on the trail that continued past the gazebo and out into a small clearing where we'd made a flower bed, buried her ashes, and laid a tombstone. I felt her with us, and I felt Leif feeling her with us too, though I didn't say a word about it, for fear my words would make the feeling go away. I dozed off without knowing it, and roused as the sun began to seep into the sky, turning to Leif with a start, having forgotten for an instant where I was.
"I fell asleep," I said.
"I know," he replied. "I've been awake the whole time. The shrooms."
I sat up in the hammock and turned back to look at him.
"I worry about you," I said. "With drugs, you know."
"You're the one to talk."
"That was different. It was just a phase, and you know it," I said, trying to keep my voice from sounding defensive.
There were a lot of reasons I regretted having gotten involved with heroin, but losing credibility with my brother was the thing I regretted the most.
"Let's take a walk," he said.
"What time is it?" I asked.
"Who cares?"
I followed him back along the trail, past the silent tents and cars and down our driveway to the gravel road that passed our house. The light was soft and tinged with the slightest shade of pink, so beautiful that my exhaustion didn't matter. Without discussing it, we walked to the abandoned house a short way down the road beyond our driveway, where we used to go as kids, bored on the long, hot summer days before we were old enough to drive. The house had been empty and falling to the ground then. Now it was falling more.
"I think her name was Violet, the woman who lived here," I said to my brother when we mounted the porch, remembering the lore about the house I'd heard from the Finnish old-timers years before. The front door had never been locked, and it still wasn't. We pushed it open and went inside, stepping over places where boards were missing from the floor. The same items that had been scattered around the house a dozen years ago were still there, amazingly, only now they were even more decrepit. I picked up a yellowed magazine and saw that it was published by the Communist Party of Minnesota and dated October 1920. A chipped teacup with pink roses on it sat on its side, and I bent to write it. The house was so tiny it took only a few steps to have it all in view. I walked to the back and approached a wooden door that hung diagonally from one hinge, a pane of pristine glass in its top half.
"Don't touch it," whispered Leif.
"Bad karma if it breaks."
We walked carefully past it and into the kitchen. There were gouges and holes and a giant black stain where the stove used to be. In the corner stood a small wooden table that was missing a leg.
"Would you carve your name into that?" I asked, gesturing to the table, my voice suddenly flashing with emotion.
"Don't," said Leif, grabbing my shoulders to give me a firm shake. "Just forget it, Cheryl. It's reality, and reality is what we have to accept, like it or not."
I nodded, and he let go of me. We stood side by side, gazing out the windows to the yard. There was a dilapidated shed that used to be the sauna, and a trough that was overrun by weeds and moss now. Beyond it, a wide, swampy field gave way to a stand of birch trees in the distance, and beyond that, a bog we knew was there but couldn't see.
"Of course I wouldn't carve into that table, and neither would you," Leif said after a while, turning to me.
"You know why?" he asked. I shook my head, though I knew the answer.
Because we were raised by Mom.
I hiked away from my camp in the clear cut at first light and saw no one all morning. By noon, I didn't even see the PCT.